After Dark, the Jaws Watch Along, Art of Darkness with the great Jacob Everett of Apocalypse Confidential. I want to read the business from Carl Gottlieb.
So tell us again who Carl Gottlieb is.
Carl Gottlieb is the fellow that you would recognize. I think he played the kind of the newsman in Jaws. He was supposed to have a bigger part, but he got written out, and he's a screenwriter. So he was doing some screen. He did a bit of screenwriting, and he was involved in that speech a little bit. And he punched up Jaws to make it a little more comic.
Okay.
So I'm just going to read this. It's so funny. The shark can locate its prey several ways. He can smell blood from a mile away, and he can sense vibrations in the water, as Peter Benchley points out in Jaws. 100 yards offshore, the fish sensed a change in the sea's rhythm. Running within the length of its body were a series of thin canals filled with mucus and dotted with nerve endings, and these nerves detected vibrations and signaled the brain. So as I read this chapter, I want you to think about Gottlieb as like an old-timey kind of comic writer. Richard Zanuck and David Brown are Hollywood producers. Although not filled with mucus, they are certainly dotted with nerve endings. And just as the great white shark can sense erratic vibrations of a swimmer in the water, so can Richard and David sense the movement of a literary property in the publishing world. They are not sharks, and they are not predators, but they are sensitive. And Jaws was still an unpublished manuscript at Doubleday when the vibrations created by the progress signaled the Zanuck Brown Company that something was up. This type of writing, yeah, is incredible. I'm going to read a few more pairs. Both men have explained to me that they have private sources in the publishing world, and they are not alone in this. Studios and producers are always on the lookout for a marketable property, a book or story that appears attractive enough to justify the expense of transforming it into a film script, and popular enough to justify the further colossal expense of making it into a theatrical feature film, where $100 million are at stake, and where the intense collaborative process of creation can occupy months or years before a finished film can be released. Be assured that whenever you read a work of popular fiction or light storytelling, it has been studied and analyzed by a number of people who are professionals at the acquisition of literary properties. If you say to yourself, this would be a terrific movie, chances are it may be, or at least someone has bought the rights to try and make it so. I want to read a little bit about Jaws here. Jaws all began in June of 1971 when Peter Benchley delivered a 4-page outline of a proposed novel to an interested editor at the New York publishing house of Doubleday. Peter's pages and a favorable editor's memo were circulated in-house, and enough editorial support was gathered to justify the issuance of a contract request for Peter. That request was approved by the publishing board, and after a little stiff negotiating, the contract was approved and entered into by both parties. It just goes on. Now, I think this is very funny. I want you to hear this just because of the type of writing. Now, as far as I can determine, in the world of publishing, the paperback publisher is like the tooth fairy. The child, author, writes a novel or something. His parents, hardcover publisher, subsidizes the work, hoping that the kid will make something out of himself and that enough people will buy the thing to take care of the publisher in his old age. Or at least make him able to afford to have other kids, some of whom are bound to be retarded or worse due to some genetic defect in the publisher's line. What ended up happening is Bantam ended up paying $575,000, which in the 70s was a lot. I mean, obviously a lot of money.
That's a lot. That's
a lot of money.
$3 million.
Something like that.
In today's dollars.
Yeah, for the paperback rights. And it was on the hardcover bestseller list for 44 weeks and was a huge paperback success. This is back when people subscribed to these book clubs, right? Book of the month clubs. And if your book was selected, it guaranteed you know, millions of sales. He'd be in millions of homes and libraries and all the rest of it. So I just thought, you know, this book, if you haven't read the Jaws log, it's worth it because this is a guy who was on the set the entire time and worked on the movie, and who has a really funny, you know, really goofy sense of humor. I'm going to read another little anecdote from it about John Milius, who, of course, if you don't know who John Milius is, you need to brush up on your Hollywood history. He directed the Conan the Barbarian movies and
Red Dawn.
Yeah, Red Dawn. And he wrote a little movie called, Apocalypse Now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that one. It's appropriate. We have Jacob from Apocalypse Confidential here.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. We'll talk a little bit more about our impressions of the movie. I just want to read one more thing. Steven has been made into an enthusiastic trap and skeet shooter thanks to the pre-production urgings of fellow director and shooting enthusiast John Milius, who is in Spain at the same time as all this is going on, getting his thrills by directing an epic period adventure yarn with lots of shooting, riding, and Spaniards. John is on time and under budget, so he's okay. Steven is over and feeling the pressure. So he proposes to those of us who are interested that we set up a device to throw clay birds over the ocean from the stern of the Orca. He will bring out his Perazzi and his Browning shotguns, and there will be a lunch hour skeet shoot during our 30-minute lunch break, just like on the luxury ocean liners, with Pukka Sahib's gunning from the stern. The crew hears this and quietly presents an ultimatum to the production manager. Steven brings loaded guns on board. They're not coming to work. In vain do we point out it's during lunch hour. It's safe and all that. The crew is unmoved. They will grant him his phenomenal professionalism as a director. He is the youngest they've ever worked with. But when it comes to guns, he's still a kid, the crew thinks, and no kids with guns on the cramped decks of the picture boat. So no shotgunning. Spielberg wanted to shoot skeet off the back of the Orca.
That sounds fun, man. That sounds like a good time.
Take a little break.
Yeah, woo! That's hilarious.
Let's air it out, boys.
Yeah. Just
watch one of the greatest movies of all time. Jacob, I know you have a special relationship with this film. What was your feeling having watched it here just now during the Summer of the Shark?
During the Summer of the Shark, yeah. I mean it's sort of hard to, you know, say, I mean, you know, what more is there to say about it? You know, I mean, we just recorded a 2-hour podcast about everything we could say about it. But, like, I don't know. I mean, it really is, in my estimation, the greatest movie ever made in terms, it's perfect. I mean, I grew up watching it. First time I watched it was in kindergarten. And, like, my mom saw it in theaters. And so she was always into it. And, like, we saw it together on, like, the big screen, like, when they did, like, a showing of it at the Hollywood Theater here in Portland. Cool. And, like, we have this Jaws rule where it's, like, anytime, no matter what else we're watching or no matter how far in it is, if we see that Jaws is playing on TV, we'll just drop in and catch it and watch it to the end.
Yeah,
and very so, cool. Yeah, and so, you know, between, like, you know, the bits and pieces from there, yeah, definitely seen it a bunch. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, what more is there to say?
There's
just perfect.
Watching it again makes me, you know, you can make a movie now and they crank out 15 or 20 of them a year that are trying to get across the same emotional response in the audience that Jaws was with 10 times the budget and all the tricks, and basically none of them are nearly as good. And, you know, it makes you just kind of think, it would make me, if I were a filmmaker, and that's not my business, but if I were a filmmaker interested in making these movies, I would sit back and say, well, what does Jaws have that, I don't know, Transformers doesn't have? Why does Jaws work so much better than that, right? Because we're screwing something up, it seems like. You know, there's no...
It seems, you know, there were so many happy accidents, or so many accidents that at the time must have felt totally miserable, but which combined with the right group of talent backed by a big studio. I mean, let's not pretend this was a big studio film. It doesn't necessarily feel that way, but it was. It was a Universal Pictures film. I mean, Zanuck Brown, they had a special relationship with Universal. They were on the Universal lot. That's where their offices were. So, yeah, and yet all of these things came together, and Spielberg's age and his sort of cohort and the fact that he was the star child, you know, in Hollywood. He was the hottest young director. He had been directing television, you know, since like right out of film school, and, you know, had a great reputation for that. So, I mean, there was all this pressure riding on it. It almost had to be something serviceable. But then these strokes of genius where instead of being a pure monster movie, it becomes this kind of Hitchcock type thriller because of what you don't see. They try to show us everything now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because you got to show off the CGI, right? You got to show off the effects, and it's, you know, there's, when Scorsese was bashing all of the Cape shit about being roller coasters or amusement park rides, I mean, he wasn't wrong. But Jaws isn't a roller coaster ride exactly. It is in some ways, but
it carries so many emotions. You're really taken on this really incredible journey. It starts out as this kind of, I mean, it starts out as a pure horror movie. This girl ends up dying in the surf, and then it becomes this kind of commentary on one man's go along to get along failure to stand up to social pressure, which is really quite a serious subject. And then he finally has to redeem himself by going to sea with this absolute archetype of the sea in Quint. It carries you the whole way until the very end. There's this extraordinarily dramatic moment where he's being lowered into the water, the thing that he's been afraid of from the minute the movie began.
Oh, that's incredible. That sequence is perfect. This ship slowly sinking, you know, pulling the rifle up, aiming, missing several times is also key to the tension of that. It's all great. It does make me think too, watching it, which I hadn't thought before, and mostly, you know, kind of stimulated by our conversation. There is something in all these monster movies about the monsters exacting a kind of justice against the justice handed down from like an inflexible moral system, right? That girl gets murdered by the shark because she's, you know, promiscuous, but like all of the, you know, the Friday the 13th movies, it's all about the promiscuous teenagers get murdered, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a little bit like that too. And I don't know, that's just an interesting thread that I think I'm going to start noticing or paying attention to more in these things. It's like you have this horrible monster, and yet the perception is that there is some kind of, it's like the unthinking agent for a moral system. It's not that the monster is moral. It's just that it happens to do God's dirty work or something. It's very strange.
Like it's like a revenger for God, where it's like, it's an immoral agent of a moral order kind of thing. And I mean, I can, you know, you mentioned Friday the 13th, and I can go the fuck off of Jason Lives, which to me is probably the greatest franchise slasher.
I've never seen Jason Lives.
Where it's like, it is kind of like, and I know Kevin saw it. He saw it during, he had like a Friday the 13th marathon, but yeah, you know, not to go, you know, this is our Jaws After Dark, not our Jason Lives After Dark, but like, yeah, it is like you get this sense where it's, you know, there's that whole what is it, it's the neo-reactionary thing, non, like it's nature or nature's God, where it is like a sort of setting right, you know, against either the promiscuous nature of humanity, or even more than that, I think it's the hubris. Because at least in Jaws, it's not so much that she's a skinny dipping, you know, she's trying to get lucky that night and, you know, smoke some weed and drink some beers and stuff. It's that she thinks as the sort of land mammal that she can impinge on the kingdom of the ocean. Mm. And so the shark comes to set her straight on that.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, in a big way.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. And she even clings to this man-made object in the sea, nice, this buoy, and before she's finally dragged under. Right. A good film to screen right after Jaws would be The Birds.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think there's some synergy between these two films. This is what I mean about Greek tragedy, Brad. They have this sense of the natural order, and if that starts to get out of whack, if man is not honoring that, then increasingly terrible things will begin to happen.
Yeah, and there's this is sort of like a subgenre. The one that just came immediately to mind was, if you guys have seen The Ghost in the Darkness, that Val Kilmer lion hunting, lion, which is pretty good. It's not as good as Jaws by any means, but yeah, this is sort of like a trope a little bit, not to demean it by any means, but
yeah, like natural horror, eco horror, because like I mean, not just like, you know, conspiracy paranoid thriller stuff, but like in the 70s, you obviously had all those disaster movies,
yeah,
that included like kind of eco-horror movies. Like, I remember seeing one called like Prophecy about like a mutated bear, and like killer ant movies and killer worm movies. And then obviously Towering Inferno and Earthquake and Poseidon Adventure, you know, to go back to the ocean. And mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is this kind of the trope of nature rebelling against man, or like man's hubris becoming like imploding on itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and Poseidon and the Towering Inferno also have a sort of a Tower of Babylon kind of thing, right? You make this grandiose thing out of your hubris, and it's like an affront to the natural order, and so the natural order's, you know, puts you back in your place. Yeah, it's
interesting. And the makers of Jaws tempted that, because in their, you know, you could argue in their man-like hubris, they try to fashion a mechanical shark, and then of course the mechanical shark, when placed in the elements of the real sharks, would just sink, or like,
right,
you know, try to kill George Lucas.
Well, thank goodness George Lucas didn't get eaten by Bruce.
Yeah, well, wow. So you imagine?
No, that would really have changed history, wouldn't it?
You would have instead an American Graffiti franchise.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to just admire how deft they were in, how agile they were, and how, because I tend to have a pretty fixed mindset when it comes to my art and to like my writing. Just that's the place I come from. But you read, the more you read about this stuff, you go, my God, you've just got to like roll with it. You've got to adapt. You have to just grab. There's a John Cage quality to Jaws that you would not think based on the finished product. But it's like, oh, well, you know, okay, well, we need a speech here. Okay, let's write this and then call my friend and he'll do this. And then we'll give it to the actor and the actor will finally bring it home. And then we're going to, it's just like not what the finished product feels like. And I guess film inclines toward this because the final thing is the final thing. And it's just this totally crystallized thing and you can't imagine it any other way. But right, then when you read how the sausage is made, you go, oh my God, this is like more like jazz than I guess anything else. And just being reminded of that is a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's just chaos, and then you got the steady hand of Verna Fields hours in the editing bay, right?
Oh my God, days, weeks.
Yeah. Just stringing it all together, making it actually make sense.
You know, you're talking about monster movies and stuff. You think about, if you're a fan of Mystery Science Theater 3000, you've seen these old movies from the 40s and the 50s where they take footage of like spiders but blow it up really big, and then the spiders are coming after the teenagers. We're not. Yeah. Jaws is not wildly different from that.
It's not. No.
I mean, it's closer
in time to that than it is to now, right? So
yeah, that's a great point. But obviously, it's on a completely different level, and it's the acting and the writing and the execution and all the rest. But fundamentally, it's still sort of the same idea. Yeah. It's also a commentary on how, like, the stubbornness and the, I don't want to say greed of man, because I don't think that these people on the island are necessarily greedy, but they need those summer dollars.
If their whole economy is based on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if they were to honor the shark, what would they do? They just shut down for the summer. But it's unthinkable that you would just shut everything down for a period of time. Makes you think about what happened over the past few years for us.
Yeah.
Is COVID the new shark? Is monkeypox the new shark? I'm not making a joke.
I know what you mean.
Look at my face. I mean, but
I know.
Really,
I think,
unseen thing, but it's contagious among other people. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, right. It can be lurking out there at any point. You could step out your door and bah, monkeypox right in your face.
I don't think that's how monkeypox spreads. Oh, okay. That's not what I've been reading.
Where I live, maybe.
Jacob, so you've got the Summer of the Shark coming up, and obviously Apocalypse Confidential. And what else do you got going on? Are you doing your podcast, The Elroy Boys? Still doing that?
Elroy Boys is on semi-permanent hiatus. We've sort of moved on from different projects. Sam's going through some personal stuff, but it's a kind of thing where it's like, you know, Elroy is eternal. So like, if ever we need to reconvene, the door is open. But yeah, other than that, just basically full on Apocalypse Confidential. After the Summer of the Shark special wraps, we have two more specials for 2022. We're going to do a war special set to drop on Armistice Day. And, then a sort of Christmas time special, like we want to do a kind of return to like Victorian era kind of cozy ghost stories.
Oh, cool.
Of Christmas time. We want to see how that goes. It might be slim pickings, but it'll be cool to see what people come up with for that one.
Yeah, no, that sounds awesome. And I know how much work that you guys are putting in, a lot of work to get that out, and it's paying off for sure. So I'm excited to read Summer of the Shark, and I might submit to this Christmas one. Surprisingly, that got me a little, like, perked my ears up a little bit. So,
Jacob, weren't you and I going to do Bacon, right? Francis Bacon at some point. Yeah, I think that's
in the... Yeah, I have that on the schedule still for...
looks like it's the end of this month, apparently. So,
too soon.
Okay, yeah, no, I might have to bump that back just a little bit because I'm so busy with the new baby. Please, but, fantastic. Let's... I'll look at the schedule and I'll push it back just a little bit, but not too far back, because I want to do that, man. That'll be outstanding. I am ready. I am... bacon pilled. All right. This is a lot of fun.
Bacon.
Bring it home. We're going to bring home the bacon.
Knowledge is power. Francis Bacon.
That's the other Francis Bacon. It's the other Francis Bacon. Hey, Jacob, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is just so much fun, man. We just love doing this. And I watch that movie every year.
Oh, yeah. No, I think just to chat with you for a bit too, man. So
rock and roll. Bacon. All right. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Take care. You guys have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too, sir.
Bye.